Robin Hood Radio presents Agriculture from Tucana Farms. Here's Mark Scherzer.
In these topsy-turvy times, the mental roadmap I've always relied on to navigate the world seems to be in a constant state of redrawing. Whenever I think I have the structure of the world figured out, some new piece of information comes along to upset things. The latest challenge to my assumptions has come from the increasing body of knowledge that suggests that plants may be conscious beings. That is, that they're aware of the conditions around them and make decisions in response to their environment to affect certain results. For example, a study published a couple of years ago in Israel demonstrated that young pea vines, with their roots divided between two pots, would generally choose to develop the roots in the pot with a constant stream of nutrients rather than the one with a fluctuating supply, provided the overall level of nutrients was adequate in both. But if there were a low level of nutrients, they would choose to develop in the pot that occasionally got a big burst of nutrients rather than the constant supply. That is, they essentially assessed risk and chose the most advantageous environment. More evidence of human-like plant behavior arrived this week. I had only read a few pages into the book Peter gave me for Christmas, The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Wohlleben, when he forwarded me an article in the February 2nd New York Times entitled, Sedate a Plant and It Seems to Lose Consciousness. Is it conscious? The underlying premise of the book is that plants have feelings and an awareness of the conditions around them, communicate with one another, take actions to enable them to avert danger and fight predators, and hunt for nutrients. In short, they exhibit a form of intelligence and a level of consciousness. The article reports on experiments in which anesthetic substances were administered to plants. Just as anesthetics prevent humans from responding to their environment, they similarly seem to close down plant functions as well. Once again, pea plants provide an illustration. As time-lapse photography showed the tendrils of pea vines waving in the air in normal circumstances, even if there's no wind, as they search out places to twine themselves around to enable them to get more light. And then once the anesthetics were administered, those same pea tendrils curled up and drooped into inactivity. When the anesthetics wore off, the sentient plant functions returned. The experiment suggests that plants, like humans, can become unconscious, as reflected in those temporarily drooping pea tendrils, and one might reasonably conclude that if a plant can become unconscious in a manner similar to humans, then it has consciousness analogous to ours as well. My first reaction on reading about plant consciousness was, I must admit, a giggle. Sure, this shakes our worldview, but what, I wondered, must this information do to the worldview of vegans, who refuse to eat meat products to avoid being responsible for killing and eating animals that they perceive as our fellow sentient beings? If it's wrong to eat animals because they're sentient beings with consciousness, then how can it be right to eat plants that are similarly endowed? To be sure, we may find it harder to understand plant consciousness because plants are not as similar to us as animals. They do not move, communicate, or show emotion in the same ways. They're not as anthropomorphic. But is it, one might reasonably ask, fair to eat them simply because we understand them less well? Will we possibly someday realize that our mechanized raising and harvesting of crops, mowing them down or yanking them out of the ground, unaware of any possible feelings they might have, amounts to a cruel and brutal slaughter? Peter swears satirically to hearing radishes scream as he eats them, but that belies his pantheistic-style reverence for plants. My initial burst of schadenfreude at the challenge this research presents to veganism was short-lived. I realize that the notion of plant consciousness also presents challenges to our self-understanding, both as farmers and omnivores. One pillar of my defense for raising livestock for food has always been that we treat our livestock with kindness and respect, allowing them to live happily in ways significantly better than they would in the natural world. We see that they're fed, watered, and protected, and give them an environment in which they can follow their instincts. The quid pro quo for our breeding them and making sure they live that way is that they feed us. We give them life, they give us life. If plants are conscious, does that mean we need to change the way we raise them to respect their feelings, to give them joy, and yes, let them achieve their full plant nature? What would that mean? Peter reminds me that Prince Charles in his younger days claimed to speak to his plants and was roundly ridiculed for it. Will we now have to consider doing something like that ourselves? How else will our horticulture change? Can we continue to chop off all those shoots and tendrils the tomato plants naturally send out as we try to tame their growth and encourage fruiting and ripening in the sun? Is it cruel to keep picking young haricot vert in order to keep the bean plants producing, when all they really want to do is nurture the seed pods to maturity and collapse? How would that be different from keeping lights on all night in the chicken coop to encourage egg production, even if it wore the chickens down and altered their metabolism? Could we really let the vegetables realize their true nature and still eat them at all? While with tomatoes and beans, we're eating the plant's seeds, lettuce, which must be harvested when young and tender for peak flavor and texture, we eat the plant itself, and it will never live to achieve its natural raison d'etre to produce seeds. Will Animal Welfare Approved, which has a strict standard for humane slaughter of animals, someday have to establish Plant Welfare Approved certification as well for humane growing and harvesting of fruits and vegetables? One hears the earliest of pleas for some sort of reform in the foreword to the life to that book, The Inner Life of Trees, where the author states, "Perhaps the saddest plants of all are those we have enslaved in our agricultural systems. They seem to have lost the ability to communicate, and as the author says, are isolated by their silence." Another of my justifications for raising and eating meat has been that there's something in the natural order of things that's determined many animals, as a matter of course, feed themselves by eating other animals. The food chain, which is the fundamental order of living beings on Earth, is a kind of grand energy transfer, usually from the smaller or more vulnerable creatures to larger ones. It seems that because it's natural for animals to eat other animals, we're simply following the natural order when we eat meat. In some ways, the realization that plant cells operate just like animal cells, waking up and going to sleep in ways indicative of consciousness, emphasizes further the unity of all life. Cells, those little bundles of energy, act similarly and serve similar purposes in both plants and animals. It's sort of a pantheistic concept of God in everything. But this realization of the unity of all life, and therefore plant and animal life, points to a conundrum which the vegans, turning the table back on us omnivores, might be pleased to see us confront. If all our internal component parts are made of the same stuff, why should any living creature be off limits as food? Why not eat worms and cockroaches? How about dogs or cats? Or even roasted obnoxious neighbors, for that matter? Why shouldn't cannibalism be considered perfectly, quote, natural, unquote? Anthropologists like Mary Douglas, the author of Purity and Danger, try to analyze eating rules of different cultures by positing that they simply represent ideological structures that have grown up in the particular idiosyncratic ways those cultures see the natural world. Douglas suggested, for example, that the rules of Kashrut, the Jewish dietary law, which prohibits eating four-legged creatures unless they have cloven hooves and chew their own cud, or aquatic creatures, which lack fins or scales, seem to have resulted from discomfort with creatures that did not fit comfortably within the animal categories of the ancient Hebrew taxonomy. For instance, having scales and fins made an aquatic creature a fish. Lacking those things made it something ambiguous, therefore made people uncomfortable, regarding those creatures as impure, dangerous, and forbidden. 40 years later, Dr. Douglas substantially modified her views on the subject, but I always thought her theory had a lot of explanatory power. The great impassioned debates between vegans and carnivores seem to me to have an equally sort of religious quality, much like the kosher rules, turning largely on categorizing our food sources, particularly in this case on the single concept of whether the food source is conscious or sentient on the one hand, or brainless on the other. Vegans argue that it's wrong to eat sentient beings and we must eat only brainless vegetables. Carnivores argue that it's okay to eat animals as long as they're discernibly different in character, consciousness, and intelligence from humans. Yet this new body of plant studies and a similarly increasing body of studies on animal intelligence teach us that these boundary lines cannot be so clearly drawn. Plants may not have formal brains, but they have intelligence, communication, and feeling nonetheless. Animal intelligence is far more acute than we give animals credit for, and we have yet to comprehend all the nuances of that intelligence. The debate between the carnivores and the vegans will undoubtedly go on, but all this new information is ultimately going to have to shift the terms of those debates in the long term in ways I don't think we can fully foresee. In the meantime, I strongly suggest that you use this moment of shifting paradigms and uncertainty to broaden your own food choices. We've got lots of preserved frozen plant and animal energy, raised with the greatest of respect for their consciousness, just waiting for your new adventures in eating. Mangez avec nous.
Peter Davies and his partner Mark Scherzer are proprietors of Turkana Farm, specializing in heritage breeds of livestock on their 40-acre farm in Germantown, New York. Peter also presides over Turkana Odyssey, in which he customizes cultural tours of Turkey for small groups, which he calls an insider's view of Turkey. And his third hat is Turkana Gallery of Old and Antique Kilims, which he operates in the Wall Street area of Manhattan. Mark presides over his law firm, Mark Scherzer Law Office, which specializes in health law, also in the Wall Street area. Their farm website, TurkanaFarms.com. Their email, farm@TurkanaFarms.com, or 518-537-3815.